Hey, Immigrantly family, this is Sadia Khan. I have some great news for all of you. We recently launched our newsletter, which comes out 3 times a week. It's called Hyphenly, which is our no-fluff newsletter with hot takes, heartfelt stories, and all the feels of living in between cultures. Come for the nuance, stay for the vibes. You can find the link to subscribe in our show notes. Don't forget to subscribe. Hello and welcome to Immigrantly. I am Sadia Khan. Before we dive into today's episode, a few housekeeping things. We have a channel on Apple Podcasts called Immigrantly Uninterrupted, where you can basically find our content ad-free. You can subscribe for a very small amount per month and have access to all our content. And beyond that, it really helps us grow. It indicates to people that Immigrantly's content matters. So if you are a frequent listener or if you resonate with Immigrantly's content, go to Apple Podcasts and subscribe to Immigrantly Uninterrupted. Basically $3.99 a month, guys. Ad-free. If you want to help us even more, you can share our podcasts, whether it's Lovely, Banterly, Sportly, or Immigrantly. Share it, subscribe to it, refer a friend, and talk about it. Maybe if there are enough of you out there, we can really form a pod club around the content we are creating and what other creators are doing. Why not? Let's talk about it. If you're interested, DM us. And now to our today's episode. What happens when a small act of survival spirals into the heart of an international drug ring? In the late 1980s, Tina Wong was just trying to get by. A housewife living in Manhattan's Chinatown, Tina said yes to a favor that would change everything. Basically, accept a package. But what she didn't know was that she would become entangled in a billion-dollar heroin smuggling operation run by one of New York's most dangerous gangsters, Johnny Yang, also known as Machine Gun Johnny. Launching this September from Pushkin Industries, a new investigative podcast, The Chinatown Sting, hosted by journalist Lydia Jean Cott, uncovers the true story of Tina and of the hidden network of immigrant mothers caught in the web of crime, coercion, and survival. And I am so psyched that I am joined by Lydia Jean Cott, the host of the show. She's a journalist who's uncovered this story not just through reporting, but through personal connection. Her boyfriend's mother was the federal prosecutor who helped bring Johnny Yang down. We'll talk about how systems of power, immigration policy, and cultural silence shaped the choices these women made and what this story can teach us today. So without further ado, let's get right into it. Welcome to Immigrantly, Lydia. Oh my gosh, I can't even believe that I'm going to talk about true crime on Immigrantly today. I've never done that before. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm so excited to be on your show. I'm such a fan. You're such a good interviewer. I was like taking notes. You do a really wonderful job of getting people to open up, and you're just such a, it's really fun to listen to the show.
Oh my gosh, you just made my day. So I was listening to the first episode of your podcast. The podcast comes out in September, and I'm really excited to listen to subsequent episodes. But something that struck me was this idea of belonging, right? You talk about how you would eat when you moved from Poland. And it got me thinking, belonging is such an interesting but elusive term. All of us have different connection and relationship with belonging. Some of us just don't want to be boxed in certain identities, and others are so fixated on identities that form who they are. After having done this podcast, how do you see your own sense of self and belonging?
My own sense of self and belonging. You know, it's kind of funny because, you know, I moved to the United States when I was 8. It was a huge deal when I moved to the United States, of course, for me, like, because, you know, it was a whole new country. Like, my mom's American from the Midwest, from Kansas City, and my dad's Polish. So in Poland, I grew up speaking both English and Polish, so I knew the language. And for my mom, it was like she was returning to her country. But for me, it was like a whole new place, right? So even though I didn't have an accent and I, you know, am white and I like looked like most kids in my school, I also was like, everything was so foreign to me. Like, I was afraid of squirrels. Like,
I'm still afraid of squirrels, if that makes any sense.
I mean, squirrels are scary. And it was also a traumatic year because my dad didn't come with us. He stayed abroad. But I kind of forgot about it. Like, I think I, like, just, you know, now, like, that was a long time ago. Like, I don't really think of myself as an immigrant because, you know, mom's American, et cetera. And it used to be such a big deal for me, but I moved on entirely. And then it was just when I was working on this podcast, I was, it kind of brought all that stuff up for me, like questions of how we try and fit in, what sort of decisions you make, like in order to fit in, how it feels to like feel on the outside. And I realized, yeah, it just brought up like those memories for me of what it was like when I first moved here and how long it took to feel like, I guess I belonged here. And then it's kind of interesting that I was able to forget that, but it's obviously a huge part of who I am still.
So was it a process for you, or was it one moment, a trigger that made you realize, yes, I belong?
I mean, part of it is also my family moved every year. So I moved every year until high school. And I don't think I ever like stopped searching for a feeling of community or belonging. I think that's always a part of me. Like, I don't know. I think my boyfriend's mom is a major part of the podcast. And I've known him since I was in elementary school. And I don't think that's like a coincidence. Like, I think part of it is I'm always kind of searching for a sense of like home and continuity and like having always like being from a place and having people who've known me for a long time, because that's like so rare for me. Like, I know some people are so excited to like leave their town and like start a new life in New York, but I've always wanted to have a town. I think I always was searching. I think I've never stopped searching for that. But I think maybe I forgot I was doing that, if that makes any sense at all.
So what is home right now in this moment?
Well, it's actually another thing that's kind of funny is that I live in Brooklyn, in the like intersection of like Greenpoint and Williamsburg. And Greenpoint, as you may know, is a Polish immigrant community. And when the first time I went to Greenpoint, I was like, I feel so at home here. Like, I have unfortunately forgotten Polish, but there's just something about hearing these old men speaking Polish, like being able to buy pierogies, like having this Polish landlady who's absolutely crazy. It does, I think, like evoke a feeling of home for me, which is kind of ironic if you think about it, because also my family's Jewish. And, you know, I like love having here, like I love how we have these like Polish guys in front of the Polish bakery. Like, it makes me feel like, you know, so at home. But then my dad visited and he was like, you know what they're talking about? Like, they're just sitting there chatting about how like they don't like the Jews.
I mean, belonging is complicated, right?
It's so complicated.
You know, I was talking to one of my guests recently, Rajiv Balasubramaniam. And honestly, that conversation made me think or rethink about how we approach belonging. Do we need those identities to latch on to? Or should we create a new human consciousness where it's all about our shared humanity and how we connect with each other as humans beyond those identifiers? But it's tough. Humans are conditioned to gravitate towards people they like and they can relate to in some capacity. I want to pivot to the podcast. So tell me, Lydia, what is the story about? Give us a brief synopsis, overview of sorts.
Yeah, so the story is about this woman, Tina Wong, who was living in Manhattan's Chinatown in the 1980s. She was a new mom, and her best friend asked her if she could receive this package in the mail. And she said, sure. And come to find out, this package was worth millions of dollars because it was a package of heroin. Inside, the package had like tea boxes in it and peppers. And hidden inside was millions of dollars worth of heroin. And Tina wasn't the only one who was accepting these packages in the mail. There was a whole group of women. A lot of them had young kids. They knew each other from playing mahjong. In Chinatown, there were these like mahjong parlors. They were kind of like, you know, places where you'd hang out with your friends and play mahjong, which I've learned how to play. It's a really fun game. And I hope this podcast actually encourages people to play mahjong because it is really fun to play. You play with like these domino-like tiles. And when one of these packages got flagged by customs, it led this federal prosecutor, this young, new, determined federal prosecutor to these women. And then from there on this like many years long quest to take down the person who was at the top of the scheme, who was this guy who was one of the top importers of heroin into New York City at the time and kind of like a big gangster in Chinatown who was kind of like there's all this mythology around him as well.
Tina Wong, she is at the center of this conversation. And without giving any spoilers, would you characterize her as the protagonist in this story?
Yes, I would. She's the protagonist. There's kind of three main characters, which are these three really fascinating women who are very different, but had a huge impact on each other's lives. And one of them is Tina Wong. She lives in New York still. She's about to retire. She worked as a hotel cleaner for a while. The other is my boyfriend's mom, Beryl Howell, who is a judge in Washington, D.C., a federal judge. And the other one is Tina's best friend. And yeah, the three of them could not be more different. And they all met and their lives were kind of never the same in a way.
Now, when you came across Tina's story, what struck you the most, not as a journalist, but as a woman?
I'm really interested in friendship and female friendship and female relationships. And it was so interesting to me the way Tina and Beryl, my boyfriend's mom, and Tina's best friend, the way that they all connected to each other and saw things in each other because they were all kind of in the same point or similar points in each other's lives when they met. They were all in their 30s. And I was actually also I was at that point when I started working on this story too. So I found that really interesting. And friendship was something I was thinking about a lot. And this is also really a story about friendship and what makes a good friend.
How did you view Tina's morality?
I mean, I love Tina. I guess I think it's interesting because I think she and Beryl have different, I think Beryl as, now a judge, a federal prosecutor, like she's all about, she loves order and she loves putting things in an order and she loves systems of order. And she views the courtroom as a place that you can create order and justice and fairness, right? But the world is really complicated and people have all sorts of things going on. And can the system really like take everything that's going on in the world and distill it in a way that creates like order and fairness? I think Tina really challenged that for Beryl. And it kind of forced Beryl to see that like the world it's complicated. People are people and they have reasons for doing things that make sense and you can really empathize with that. Maybe like the eyes of the law is just like, that's a crime. But you're like, there's historical context. Like you want, you know, I think her not wanting to like get her best friend in trouble, like all of that stuff is, I think, just as right and moral. You could argue it's less moral to like snitch on your friend, right? But in the eyes of the law, the moral thing to do is to like, and I'm, you know, Beryl would say like the right thing to do is to like tell on your friend. I think it's, I don't know. I think they both have a fair point.
Okay. If you were in that situation, would you snitch on your friend?
If I was facing decades in prison and I would be separated from my baby daughter, and if I told on my friend, I knew that she could go to prison for a long time. I mean, I want to say I don't think there's a right answer here. I think that the system has put you in an impossible situation. I don't think there's, you can't win. And that's kind of the thing. It's not right. So I feel like if I say which I would do, then I would be like tipping the scales. But it's like, you've already lost. Like, I think that framing it as a choice is also a little bit misleading because it's not a fair choice.
That's true. That makes so much sense. Let's talk about the system. Now, through this story, you're also trying to connect what was happening in the 1980s as a consequence or a through line with the Chinese Exclusion Act. Talk to me a little bit about the system, how Chinese community was treated at the time. Let's set a stage or a backdrop against which Dina did what she did.
Yes, I will do that. But I am curious, what would you do?
I am somebody like your boyfriend's mom who really believes in order. So I would do what I think is the right thing. But honestly, as you said, it's so difficult. I don't know. I mean, these are all hypotheticals, right? Who knows what I would really do at the time? Sitting in my cozy living room right now, I would gravitate towards doing the right thing.
Well, what's the right thing?
You're right. I mean, is snitching on your friend the right thing? That's tough.
Yeah. I mean, I think at the end of the day, just to kind of like wrap that up, I think most people would snitch on their friend. And I think it's just too hard not to. You're just one person against this much larger system that's telling you to do it. And that's why I think it's not really a choice. And I think people are, there's so much pressure, you know, like I think people can feel really bad for snitching or cooperating. But I don't know. Beryl was kind of like, they didn't really have a choice.
Yeah. And I can understand that. And we will come back to not having a choice, but having some agency through the process, because I do want to talk about Tina's agency in this process, right? Because a lot of times when these stories are told, we take agency away from main characters. We'll come back to that. But let's go back to the system.
So in telling this story, and I told it with my co-reporter, Xu Yuwang, and friend, we kind of realized that you can't, like, to tell a story about what's about Chinatown, you have to kind of understand how Chinatowns came to be and like the history of that. And I didn't know so much about like the history of Manhattan's Chinatown and how really the reason it exists is because, you know, Chinese immigrants originally, many came to the West Coast during the time of the Gold Rush. And then there was, you know, they helped build the railroad that connected the East and West Coast to the United States. And then the railroad didn't have like the immediate positive economic benefits that people on the West Coast thought it would. There was sort of like a recession. Sentiment really turned against Chinese immigrants violently. Like, you know, there was the driving out where Chinese immigrants were really like forced to leave the West Coast. Stores were raided, houses were burned down. Like, it's a period of history that's, I think, not super, super talked about. Like, I didn't learn about that in school, at least. Maybe it's different now.
Which is so ironic, right?
You know, some were actually forced to take the railroad that they had built and get out of, you know, leave their towns on the West Coast. And some eventually made it to East Coast cities, including New York. And, you know, this is like the 1800s. And this is kind of how Manhattan's Chinatown was formed. So, like, I've talked to historians who said it really is a place that, you know, like a legacy based on exclusion. Like, they were forced from the West Coast to come here. And then also, you know, there was the Chinese Exclusion Act that was passed around this time. And then that made it really hard for Chinese immigrants to come to the United States. I think it was one of the first, was it the first immigration law? It was definitely the first one that was targeted at a specific ethnicity. And then the other thing I learned from historians that I think like you don't necessarily think about is the exclusion era. It wasn't just about not allowing new Chinese immigrants in. It was also about excluding the Chinese immigrants that were here in all sorts of legal ways, societal ways, from like society at large. So in that way, like Chinatowns were kind of like created as like safe havens. Chinese immigrants could like gather and like be safe and have a place. And also like that history is like part of like the isolation of Chinatowns, like isolated them. And I think because of this legacy of like exclusion and isolation, that leaves its scars for like a really long time. And I think in order to understand like why there were like gangs in Chinatown in the 1980s, like you have to understand how Chinatown became so like isolated and excluded because of racist U.S. immigration policies and this like xenophobic sentiment. Didn't go away in the 1800s.
Can you share some information about Tina's own family? How did her family come to the U.S.? What was her immigration status in the 80s? What was going on?
Yeah, so Tina was born in the United States. Her mom is Portuguese and her dad immigrated from China. When she was born in like the late 1950s, Chinatown was actually really small because after World War II, like a small number of Chinese immigrants were able to come, but really it wasn't until 1965 when Chinese immigrants were able to come to the United States in like real numbers. So when Tina was growing up, Chinatown was very small and she was actually one of the few Chinese kids like in the United States. And she's also half Chinese. So that's part of her experience as well. So she kind of had this interesting thing of being one of the few Chinese kids like at her school and standing out for that reason. And then when she was like 7 or 8, like all of these Chinese immigrants came and she, to them, you know, she's half Chinese. So she wasn't like fully fitting in and she doesn't speak Chinese. She only speaks English because she grew up here. So I think that that's partly why this friendship that she became best friends with this troublemaker who is also incredibly awesome and so charismatic. And she was this girl who was really, you know, popular in Chinatown. And like she was able to like pull Tina into this like community and world and really make her feel part of it. And I can understand why that would be like alluring to Tina, who hadn't really had such a community like that before.
So let's talk about Tina some more. Now, Tina was aware of what she was doing, right? I am curious to know what made her particularly vulnerable to being pulled in to this network of women, often mothers, to move heroin. What was about her that led her to accept this proposition?
I think it was, you know, a confluence of many factors. Like, it's not like she had another like high-paying job. She had actually started this program at FIT. Like, she would have been the first person in her family to get a college degree. But both of her parents got cancer, like one after the other. And she was on the scholarship and she had to take care of them. And she missed so many days of school that she lost the scholarship. And it's actually, there's this moment that really stood out to me where she talks about how she went to school and they had ripped open her locker and like taken all of her art supplies. So she was kind of like, this isn't a pathway for me. You know, she didn't have like a way to make a lot of money and she had a family. So I definitely think the economic part is, you know, something. But I think there's other part of it is, her friend asked her to, her best friend.
So it was about loyalty as well to her friend.
I think it was about loyalty and wanting to be close to her friend. I mean, I think friendship, to me, friendship, again, is like a big, it's a big part of the story. And that's what really resonated with me is like, what would you do for your friends?
Let's dig deeper into the socioeconomic part of this, right? A lot of times when we think of belonging, we think of physical markers, physical identifiers of how we look, our skin color, even the language we speak, the accents we have. But seldom do we talk about socioeconomic challenges that people face and how that defines how they belong, especially in the US. How do you see that play out in this story, particularly for Tina? And we've talked about choices. Do you think, at least from your vantage point, from the research that you've done, the way you see this story, she had a choice?
I mean, of course she had a choice. Like, she didn't have to accept the package of heroin. So yes, but I think that the context for choices is really important. And I think people forget that. I think it matters what choices you're presented with and like what you're choosing between, right? Like, in my community, it's just much less likely that I would have a friend who's like, would you receive a box of heroin for me? Like, I don't have to, I'm choosing between different things. And I think that's like a really important difference.
So having limited choices is what you are referencing to, right?
Yeah.
She had choices, but very limited choices. And this was one of the choices that made more sense for her at the time.
Exactly. And many people would make different choices. So I'm not trying to like excuse her or whatever. Like, someone could have chosen differently. That's absolutely true. But the choices that you're choosing among, I think, are also really important.
How do you think she expressed agency through this?
I think that she made a very clear choice of what she, this kind of put in her perspective, what is most important to her, and that is her daughter. And she wanted to be there for her daughter. She wanted to make a good life for her daughter. She wanted to be a good mom. And what she decided to do from the moment of when she was caught was like, I think her daughter was kind of her North Star. She made choices based on what she thought would be best for her daughter. And I think that's why, not to give away the ending of the story, but I think she doesn't necessarily have regrets because she stands by what she chose in the end.
Let's talk about that. You said she wanted to be a good mom. I listened to the first episode, and at least what I took away from it was she isn't fully content with the kind of mom that she was. She refers to herself as the best she could be, but she doesn't really congratulate herself. She recognizes that nuance, and she recognizes that she wasn't the perfect mom. Do you think the pressure to be a good mom also played into the kind of choices that she was making, despite the fact that a lot of times the expectation is so high that people forget that moms are also humans, if that makes sense? Did you see that play out in her life?
I'm not a mom, but I do feel like I felt from her that, you know, from the moment that she had her baby, she really wanted to keep her baby safe. And she was worried about whether or not she would be good enough and be able to do that, which I can empathize with, like that feeling of like when you want something so bad, you know, and you're just so worried that you're not going to be able to like live up to that, or be that you're going to somehow like mess up about the thing that you care about most in the world. So I think she put a lot of pressure on herself in the beginning, when she first had her daughter. And I think that's some of what you're picking up in the first episode. But I think she does have a journey. And I think at the end, she does find her way as a mom and becomes the type of mom that she wants to be and raises a daughter who she's really proud of.
Did working on this story challenge your understanding of the model minority narrative or myth?
Yeah, that's a good question too. I mean, it was interesting. I was talking to my co-host, Shuyu. We were like recording for our last conversation about what we learned. And she's, you know, she immigrated from a region outside of Hong Kong. She came here for law school in like the 2020s. And she said she wanted to work on this story with me because she wanted to know about the, you know, woman who came to New York from the same region as she did, like decades earlier, as a way of kind of like connecting with previous generations of immigrants and feeling closer to them. And she said that, you know, what she had heard, or what you hear a lot, and it's definitely true, is, you know, it was so hard for previous generations of immigrants, like Chinese immigrants. They had to work really hard. They worked all these hours. They were, you know, trying to create a better life for their children. And that is 100% true. But she was like, what surprised me is also like the people who we interviewed, they were so fun. Like, they were punk. Like, they were a bit wild. And, you know, they listened to Madonna and, like, went to nightclubs and, like, sure, made some bad choices and then learned from them.
Which is okay, because that's what humans do. And however we frame or box them, they exist on a vast spectrum of humanity. And hence, boxing any community into one identity or one dimension of who they could be, whether being hardworking or, I mean, I hear this a lot about South Asians, doctors and engineers, all of that is a myth, right? Because then we are really reducing people to either professions they have or their immigration status in a way.
Yeah, exactly. So it was cool to, like, learn about this, like, you know, other side of life in Chinatown in the 1980s. And yeah, the nightclubs that they went to and, like, all the fun things too. And the, like, Chinatown arcade and this bar called Grandpa's that everyone talked about that was, like, really smoky, where they apparently had, like, incredible food. Like, it was kind of fun to hear about this kind of, like, 1980s punk Chinatown.
So again, without giving any spoilers, whatever happened in the end, do you think, knowing what you know right now, and hopefully we'll find out once we listen to the podcast when it comes out, in your reporting, did you feel that Tina was treated fairly, or was she just another casualty in a system that's, again, focused on outcomes, not people, especially people who do not look like the dominant population?
That's such a good way to put it, of, like, focused on outcomes and not on the people. That's something that I talked to Beryl about a lot, and how, you know, for her as a prosecutor and as a judge, you know, this case took many twists and turns and the outcomes were not always what she was expecting. But she said that, like, what she hopes, like, I think she told me, like, if she has grandkids to listen to this, like, what they take away from it is that she always did her best to treat people fairly. So not the outcome, but, like, what happened along the way. And that, you know, she felt like from working on this case, like, her world was, like, really expanded by, you know, talking to these women and building these relationships. I think Tina's take is a little more nuanced. Like, I told her that and she was like, Pearl doesn't understand our world.
Which is true, though.
Absolutely. But I also think that, you know, Tina wouldn't have opened the door to me when I showed up out of nowhere and said that my boyfriend's mom prosecuted her if she felt purely negatively about my boyfriend's mom. I think that what she feels is complicated, but I think that it's not a black and white ending, kind of, if that makes sense.
I'm curious to know what led Tina to trust the authorities. And we keep going back to the notion of choice and how much choice did she even have. But I wonder, hoping that she had some agency in the decision that she made, what led her to, I don't want to use the term comfortable because I cannot really fathom her being comfortable, but being able to trust authorities to make the choices that she made.
Yeah, I'm not sure that she trusted the authorities. I think at the end, you know, at a certain point, you know, Beryl was like, I felt so betrayed because I felt like, you know, we were the people who could protect her. And, like, she didn't trust us fully. And I said that to Tina and she was like, literally, why would I trust them?
So talk to me about that.
She was like, they came in, they said they were going to, like, take away my daughter. Like, what do you mean you feel betrayed? Why would I trust? I think she made the best decisions she felt like she could out of the options that were displayed, but I don't think she fully trusted the authorities.
And from what you're telling me, it seems like the prosecutor felt betrayed.
Yes, she
did. That she did not fully trust them. I'm asking you, as a journalist, as a reporter, as somebody who's observed the process, why, in your opinion, do you think she felt betrayed?
Oh, why did my boyfriend's mom feel betrayed?
Yeah.
I think she felt betrayed because part of what the podcast dives into is the relationship between a cooperating witness and a prosecutor, which is a really interesting relationship, right? It's like two people who would never meet in any other circumstances. you know, usually like very, at least Tina and Beryl, very different people, but they create this partnership that's built on trust. Like the way the deal is supposed to work is that Tina gives Beryl, and the cooperating witness gives the prosecutor information that's truthful and complete. And then in exchange, the prosecutor doesn't have any control over like the sentencing. The judge decides the sentence, but the prosecutor can ask the judge to give a lesser sentence, and the judge will take that into consideration. So to Beryl's mind, she's like, that was the deal. Tina does X, I do Y. And then she was like, I don't feel like Tina did X, so therefore I feel betrayed.
If I were to see it from a completely rational point of view or vantage point, I would say there is no such thing, or at least emotions like trust and betrayal shouldn't even be part of this, right? Because it's not going to happen. At some point, somebody will feel betrayed or mistrusted because of the dynamic that exists between people who are really on the opposite ends of this mayhem that's unraveling, right? It's just not possible. It doesn't make sense. Why would the expectation of trust, especially from a prosecutor,
for no one to feel distrusted or betrayed, you're saying?
The whole premise is set on power dynamic in a way. You cannot trust somebody who is more powerful than you and is in some ways forcing you to make choices that you wouldn't make otherwise.
Absolutely. Why would she trust her? Then why should she get trust back? But people are humans. So like, I think even prosecutors are humans.
Right. That's true. That's true. So Lydia, in today's climate of immigrant scapegoating and surveillance and all these negative stories around immigrant identity, what lessons do you think the Chinatown sting offers us? And what conversations do you hope this podcast will ignite?
Well, I was thinking, you know, while working on it, that just like the irony of the president saying, you know, all of these things that remind me so much of like this era of exclusion that I was researching, of like, you know, talking about like deporting immigrants and not letting immigrants in and making people feel like they don't belong here, and how that so directly led to problems like gangs that he is saying he's addressing. So I hope that when people listen, they're able to make that connection.
And what is one assumption? I'm sure there are many, but one misconception, assumption that you want people to set aside, let go of before they hit play?
I guess I would really want them to have an open mind and be able to hear, really take in both people's perspectives, both Beryl's and Tina's perspectives. To me, this is a story where to some degree, everyone is in the right. And I hope people can see why I think that.
In the end, if you were to define...
Oh, this one! Oh my gosh, I was trying to listen. I was like, should I listen to every episode and see what the words were so that way I don't do a repeat?
So if you were to define the United States of America in a word or a sentence, how would you do that?
I would say, okay, this is what I landed on. I'm curious what you think. I would say mythologized.
Ah, I love that.
Okay, yes, you love it. And I would say that that's not necessarily a bad thing. I read somewhere that when you're in love with someone, you see them as better than they are. And I think the question is, what do you do with that? Do you use your belief that something is better than it is to make it as better as you imagine it is? Or does it like blind you to its faults?
Ah. Mic drop. I love it. I love it. That's so true. Lydia, this was so much fun. You are a delight, as an interviewee. I am so glad we were able to do this. And when you said you live in Brooklyn, I am bummed because we could have done this in person, by the way. Yeah, I mean, I have to start telling people that I live in New York. So if my guests are in New York, I always like to meet them in person and just sit with them in a studio. But this was so good. Now tell me, when does the podcast launch? Where can people find it?
I actually, I haven't listened to it. I'm too nervous.
Oh! Okay, so let me tell you. You love it.
It is coming out the second week of September, and you can listen to it wherever you listen to podcasts, and it's called The Chinatown Sting.
And by the way, I'm a huge fan of Pushkin podcasts. They do such a good job, especially with podcasts like these. And I'm so glad that you guys were able to bring something so profound and timely for audiences to really dive in. So thank you for that. But where can people find you? Are you on Instagram or any other social media?
I'm on Twitter under my name, Lydia Jean Kott. It's LIDIAKOTT. Lydia Jean, Jean like the pants, Lydia Jean Kott.
I love it, Lydia. Thank you so much for this wonderful conversation.
Oh, it was so nice to get to talk to you. Thank you.
I can't wait to listen to The Chinatown Sting, which, by the way, comes out in September. I know this interview is a bit early, but I promise once the podcast comes out, we'll be sure to remind you that it's out. Don't forget to check it out. It's such a wonderful story of courage, agency, yes, resilience, but there's so much more to Tina's story than just resilience. This episode was produced and written by me, Sadia Khan. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our sound designer and editor is Lou Raskin. Other music is by Epidemic Sound. Our theme music is by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. Come back next week when I have another incredible story for all of you. Take care, be kind, and enjoy summer while it lasts.